Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jamie Hobecki, and I'm a senior public health specialist at the Manchester, New Hampshire Health Department. And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our HEAL project, our Healthy Eating, Active Living project. It's a Convergence Innovation Fund project through the National Convergence Partnership, and it's also partially sponsored through a local state foundation known as the H&H Foundation. So just a little presenter disclosure first. I have no financial or commercial interests related to this presentation to disclose today. To give you a little overview of what I plan to talk about for a framework, some practical approaches that we've used when looking at some research tools from a local public health practice perspective. I'll talk a little bit about a neighborhood-based methodology that we've used to assess the built environment, prioritize recommendations, and make intervention improvements. And then finally, talk a little bit about the importance of engaging the community resident as well as multidisciplinary partners in this work, without which none of this would be possible. So first, I just want to back up a little bit and talk a little bit about where we started. As a local health department, we really had an interest to get more information, more data at a local level. In Manchester, within New Hampshire, if you're familiar, it's primarily a rural state, but Manchester is definitely an urban area. So looking at our diversity as well as our socioeconomic status at the neighborhood level is really important because it varies greatly, and it can only be within, you know, several blocks of one another. So here in the northern part of the city has approximately a 2% poverty rate. And then just blocks from that, if we're starting to get into this area here, these neighborhoods here, it's about 45% poverty. So it's huge, huge differences just blocks away. So when we're starting to look at our health data, we're seeing the similar patterns. So this is age-adjusted coronary heart disease mortality at a census tract level, and even after adjusting for traditional confounding factors, we found that this area in here is still about 1.5 to 2 times higher than the surrounding neighborhoods. So for us, really, the question at a local health department level is, why are we seeing these differences, and what can we do about it in practice? So I think in public health where we tend to stop, and I certainly have a health education background, and this is where I was trained, is to think about the risk behaviors. So to think about the disease, think about heart disease, think about its common risk factors, and how we can design our health promotion and health education efforts around those risk behaviors to make behavior changes. And often what we weren't thinking about was really the neighborhood or social context in which people live and the surrounding societal influences. So, for instance, in Manchester, for us, it wasn't enough for us to go out and just talk about nutrition education or how to be physically active. For us, it was looking at the neighborhood areas to see what features distinguish those neighborhoods from other neighborhoods that fare better when we're looking at health outcomes. And so what we did with the data is we used some analysis through a geocoding project that was available through Harvard to look at the relationship between area-based poverty and coronary heart disease mortality. And what we found is that the mortality rates are about 1.5 to 2 times greater in areas of higher deprivation than lower deprivation. And beyond that, we found that about 70% of the variation or differences between the high deprivation areas and low deprivation areas was due to neighborhood poverty or deprivation. So really, the environmental context was what we needed to be looking at when we're trying to structure our interventions at the local level. And again, it's not to eliminate health education approaches. Obviously, that would eliminate my profession, so I don't want to eliminate my profession. It's just to complement that. So thinking about health education and promotion in the context of environmental behavior change. So in Manchester, these are the northern neighborhoods that I mentioned. It's primarily single-family homes, a lot of green space around their homes, front yards and backyards, well-landscaped, and then walkable environments, sidewalks that have some of the known attributes of walkability, tree coverage, a buffer between the sidewalk and the street, nicely landscaped, a lot of interesting things to look at. Over here, it's mostly multi-family housing. So this property here actually contains about 15 to 20 apartment units. There's not a lot of green space around the properties. Most of the children are actually playing in alleyways. This is actually an alleyway as their backyard area. And then here, when we're looking at the sidewalk structure, there's no buffer between traffic. It's not very interesting. And actually, there's a lot of obstruction within the sidewalk itself. So what the HEAL project set out to do is to use policy and environmental change strategies to improve neighborhood walkability and access to healthy and affordable foods. For the purposes of today's presentation, I'm only going to focus on goal one, which was to create safe neighborhoods that support physical activity as a part of everyday life. But just know that the second step of this project is to look at the food environment as well. So a couple of frameworks, tools, and approaches that have been very helpful to our project on the local level have been, first, the behavioral model of environment, which is a framework that looks at known attributes of walkability. So basically, they have four different elements: destination, distance, density, and route. We use these features to determine what type of assessment we do of the environment. So when we're looking at our walkability audit data, we would actually frame our walkability assessment, our resident survey questions, and other assessment tools based on this framework. We also utilize quality improvement methods, such as the Plan, Do, Study, Act cycle of improvement, as well as health impact assessment, and tried to think of things in small increments of change so that we could test their effectiveness and really see if what we were doing was making the difference that we wanted to see. And health impact assessment was a great tool for us to look at projected changes, both positive and negative, for any interventions we had decided to take on. We also use principles of community-based participatory research, and really this is the cornerstone of our project. It's imperative that we must engage the community resident as an empowered partner in this type of work, and not just to ask them the question of what the community need is, but to ask them what changes need to be made and engage them in that process. And lastly, we used a multidisciplinary approach. Again, we couldn't do this work without our partners. So thinking about other entities beyond the traditional people we engage within public health, like planning departments, highway departments, even law enforcement played a critical role in these efforts. So when we're looking at our project structure, we broke it down into four steps. This is our neighborhood-based methodology. So the first step was to conduct the neighborhood assessments based on that behavioral model of environment that I just spoke of. The first component of our neighborhood assessment work was a resident survey. And this survey tool really included traditional elements that you would see in any type of survey tool, looking at things like behaviors, perceptions of safety from both a traffic as well as a crime and violence perspective, and then access to basic services to sort of get at that destination and distance piece of the behavioral model of environment framework. But lastly, and most importantly, we took the time to ask people not only about their needs, but how they would improve their neighborhood, and ask them for specific ideas about how we could sort of transform their neighborhood. And just the next three slides are just to sort of illustrate that. So if you see here, we asked, please identify your top neighborhood concerns and needs. And I think often this is where we go in public health. We ask people, what are your concerns? What are your needs? We take that information back to our offices and take a look at it, look at our evidence-based practices, and design an intervention that we feel is appropriate. But from what we've learned with this project, a lot of the things that we would have designed based on this slide would not have been getting at the root cause of the issue, and I'll explain why. So here we see traffic as the top concern, 46%. So if we were to take that and try and design strategies based on evidence, there's a number of different areas and different ways that you could go about making improvements in traffic. So the next question we asked them was, what could make your neighborhood a better place to live? And we included some canned responses. And again, from an EPI perspective, I realized how critical it is to use some canned responses versus just an open response, because it makes it easier for you to sort of analyze your data. However, again, this was still very limiting for us. So it came up again here, reduce the speed of car traffic. So it's not just the traffic, it's the speed of the traffic. So we're getting a step further to what is really the root issue. And then finally, we just left it open and said, well, what do you mean when you say reduce the speed of car traffic in your neighborhood? And what we found here is really what people were talking about is improvements within alleyways. that they were concerned not just about car speed and the traffic volume, but they were concerned about it within the context of the alleyways in particular. And reason why is because, as I mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, most children and families are playing in these areas because it's their, considered their backyard space. And in fact, when we conducted our surveys, we actually went to the back doors and walked down these alleyways to engage the most residents. If we went to the front door, most people weren't even available. So this is just to illustrate how important for our project it was to really ask people, even though it can be an epi nightmare, to sort of ask people exactly what you would like to see happen within your neighborhoods and really explain and get that dialogue going. The second component of our neighborhood assessment work was a walkability audit, and we used a tool from the San Francisco Department of Public Health to look at both functionality from the standpoint of are there sidewalks in place, proper curbing, lighting, as well as thinking about the aesthetics of the neighborhood. So if there are abandoned properties, trash and graffiti, things of that nature. And as you can see here, the red indicates areas of low functionality. So we took that data, and the last component of the assessment work that we looked at was actually looking at accident data. And we overlaid our accident data on our functionality data to see if there were any areas where we had somewhat of a correlation between low functionality and high pedestrian accidents. And what we found is there were a couple of areas, such as this, that cropped up as real concerns for us. And what it allowed us to do is to go back to that audit data and pull out more of the rich data that we needed to look at what are the actual issues. So there's no crosswalk buttons in these areas. There's also a local park. This is actually a street right here. There's a local park here and here, so the street actually divides the park. There's no crosswalks or safety areas through here. And there's a local elementary school that's actually on the other side of the park. So a lot of children are actually using the park to as like a cut through to get home. And when we looked at the age ranges of people who were in those accidents, there were actually a lot of children on bicycles that were the victims of those accidents that happened in this area. The second step of our process was to identify policy and environmental change recommendations. So we took all of that data and brought it back to community meetings. And at first, we wanted to start our own community meetings and learned quickly that not to start your own, but to think about what already exists within the community to capitalize on it. So we're using groups like neighborhood watch groups and parent-teacher associations that already have an interest in their neighborhood and an interest in their neighbors and are doing similar work already. And what they did was they helped us look at the data and come up with some priority areas. So this particular neighborhood identified three different areas of interest: improvements in pedestrian safety, converting a passive green space to an active park destination, and then finally looking at the alleyways that I mentioned. So in addition to identifying the priorities, we also had other things that were identified as a part of recommendations for our longer-term plan. So it's our goal to take all of that information and actually develop a neighborhood-specific action plan that we can work on and work towards over the next 3 to 5 years. And this is a nice tool in a local community to bring to a funder because it makes things more tangible for them. And it's also a great tool to be able to say that the residents worked with you on this, that this is coming up from the community. It's not just us looking at this data, these data, and making these decisions. And also from a resident's perspective, it engages them in the process to understand how long it takes to make some community change and really appreciate some of the work and legwork that goes into that because I think people aren't usually exposed to that process on a local municipal level. And then finally, we were going to implement at least one of the priority recommendations. We were fortunate enough to be able to look at all three of the priority areas that I mentioned, and this is where our non-traditional partners come in, looking at working with highway planning and parks and recreation departments in particular. So here we took our pedestrian safety improvements and we're working with highway to identify area improvements at a neighborhood level, so things like crosswalk striping and imprinted crosswalks. They look like this. And I have to say, working with these partners, you learn a lot more about their disciplines and probably even want to know, and some of the limitations that you might encounter. So, for instance, thinking about New England weather, you know, I'm coming from New Hampshire. I was like, we'll just put speed bumps and speed tables everywhere. And from a weather perspective, it's a nightmare from plowing and snow removal. So there's a lot of things that I think are in the evidence that would be great for local communities, but you have to take that into context. We're working with Parks and Recreation to look at that local park that people wanted to see improved into more of an active area. So this is what it looks like currently and what it could be. So we have a playground area for children. We'd reduce some of the trees in here to increase the sight line. There were a lot of concerns about safety and lack of lighting. We'd put in lighting areas, create a central plaza area for congregating to make it more official that people could have community-based events in this area, and then leave some space open for recreation. And then finally, the feature that the community actually liked the most, which I was very excited about, is a walking path that actually goes around the park perimeter. And they came up with ideas about putting up signage related to distance, you know, how long it would take you to walk, you know, how many laps is a mile, for instance, and then maybe even some physical activity stations. And those were all resident ideas that they were coming forward with. And then lastly, thinking about livable alleyways concept design, we've been working with the Planning and Community Development Department to transform our alleyways into pedestrian-friendly areas. So currently, they're more about roadway, getting traffic, you know, to cut through different segments of our neighborhoods, but then also the residents who live there actually park in the back of their buildings, so they're pulling down the alleyways for parking. So we're working with them to maybe transform them into more of what we're calling home zones. And there's been some literature out there as well, thinking about traffic calm zones, residential alleyways, again, making the focus more about the pedestrian, and then finally thinking about some of the residential parking management issues. So that's all I have. Thank you very much for your time and attention.